is really now about looking at community as a place that offers people the opportunity to thrive or not. And if we construct communities that don't offer people a chance to thrive, we're going to make their lives much harder.
Hi, this is Ike Evans of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health, and you're listening to Into the Fold. The Hogg Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more, visit us at Hogg, and that's hogg.utexas.edu. The Hogg Foundation sees its long history in Texas as one of its chief assets. Not only has the foundation been a firsthand witness to the evolution of mental health systems and services in Texas, but to the very concept of mental health. Consider that we were once the Hogg Foundation for Mental Hygiene, not adopting our current name until 1957. And even today, there are many different ways to talk about and support mental health and people with mental health conditions, not all of which are fully compatible. We know mental health is complex and rooted in many different factors, including genetics, environment, culture, and individual life experience. So one of our challenges is to achieve a new synthesis in our understanding of mental health, one which sees mental health not as an abstraction, but as belonging to the here and now context in which people live their daily lives. We live in the context of our communities and networks. To incorporate mental health in our daily lives, we might need to direct our attention to communities. What does it mean for communities to support mental health? What creates the conditions for mentally healthy communities? Which brings me to our first guest. Ken Thompson is a member of the Hogg Foundation's National Advisory Council. He's here to give us some perspective on where he thinks the larger mental health movement is going, in light of where it has been. Ken, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure to be here.
So it was at a recent meeting that you broke down the evolution of mental health into three distinct phases. So for our listeners, what are those, in your opinion?
So, well, to try to capture this a little bit, I'm trying to talk about how mental health has evolved in a relatively broad scope, but the approach that I was talking about was a sort of thinking from the perspective of mental health issues or psychiatric challenges present certain problems to a community, to a society, and how that society responds to those problems changes over the course of history. So it kind of breaks down into the following pattern in my mind, anyhow. The first is that we started out really with having a very not clear conception of what a psychiatric challenge was or what an issue might be that constituted what we now call a mental health issue. In those days, this is, you know, we're talking really sort of before the industrial era, before the Enlightenment. Back into the 14th, 15th, maybe into the 16th century. So I'm talking a big time, you know, big span of time ago. The notion was that people who had these kinds of behaviors or unusual propensities were possessed, were morally corrupted, and various different kinds of witchcraft, various different kinds of ways of thinking about them. And gradually, as we became more rationalistic in our thinking, there was a shift to begin to think of folks as having something that was wrong with them and how their bodies and minds were working. And we moved towards a societal effort to try to find an environment where we could take care of folks like this. Movement accelerated to institutionalized people, that we had discovered the power of the institution, that if you collect people and you have the same kind of people with the same kinds of problems in the same place, you can develop some expertise and some resources and capabilities to take care of them. So we really began to think, I think, that the way to take care of people with psychiatric problems was to extract them from society, put them into a healthy living environment. And initially, the state hospitals, much to the opposite of how we eventually came to see them, were, you know, they were basically working farms, many of them. And the reports are, at least initially, that people would go into these places and come out relatively quickly. Now, the criteria that got you in and, you know, the circumstances that kept you in there were probably very different than what we would think about or condone today. And examples of that is that in those days, vast majority of people, increasingly as the institutions grew, were people who had migrated to the United States relatively recently. There was a tendency for women to get confined. So there's issues of power and issues of race and other things, gender, that come up in all this, that fuel a lot of this. And as these institutions grow, because the states are now committed to doing this as a way to solve the problem of psychiatric challenges, two things happen. One, it doesn't work very well. People kind of end up in the hospitals, in these state hospitals, and they just don't leave. Many of them, you know, end up spending an entire lifetime there. Secondarily, related to that, they became increasingly expensive. One of the conditions of the way the United States was set up initially is that the states carry the burden of social welfare services, at least initially. And in those days, there was no federal government and no federal government's capacity to address the social needs of the population. So by the 1950s, the largest single item in the state's budget is maintaining their state hospitals. One state, New York State in particular, had over 100,000 people in state hospitals at any particular time. So the reaction started to grow up, you know, and took a number of years to mobilize, probably, you know, starting at least in the 1910s, 1920s. And there was a clear perception by the time World War II was over that the conditions in these state hospitals had really deteriorated. And there's some famous studies about the circumstances that people were living in. I can tell you this, one of those hospitals in New York State had over 10,000 people living in it. It had enough people living there to sustain 12 functioning barbershops, as I've been told in the past. The institutions became really sort of maligned. And this idea that institutions offered a solution to the problem of psychiatric challenges was clearly undermined. And people began to think that not only were these institutions bad and not good places to live, that they were actually creating the psychiatric conditions that they were supposed to treat. The theory was that what was really needed was to create community capacity to take care of people's in the community, in outpatient clinics. So we built, starting in the 1960s, we never got to the number we were supposed to, and we never got the resources that I think people had hoped. We built a lot of community mental health centers, and the framework switched in general to beginning to think about how to take care of people in community. Housing became more and more available. And I guess I should say, you know, as a myth buster, a lot of people tend to think that the reason all this stuff happened is because we suddenly had new medications that allowed people not to have to be in the hospital. Actually, the truth is that the biggest changes that led to the state hospitals being depopulated in terms of numbers was that we created two very important social welfare benefits, and that is Medicaid. Medicaid was started in 1964, 65, and allowed for state hospitals to take particularly older residents and have them move into nursing homes. By doing that, to go more onto the federal budget and off the state budget, which was a godsend to the state hospital systems in terms of their cash issues. So they were able to depopulate significantly. On top of that, and very critical to the movement out of the hospital, was the institution of supplemental security income, known as SSI, which came into being around 1972. And that allowed people to finally have money to pay rent, so that if they were in a state hospital and they were discharged previous to that, they'd have no way to sustain themselves. What happened is that the center of gravity shifted for people with psychiatric challenges now to be in communities. And as soon as that started to happen and people began to really realize what that meant, initially the focus had been on making sure that there was psychiatric care available to people who are now living in community. And that, that, as I said, was somewhat challenging because there wasn't always the resources to make sure that there was psychiatric care. That, and that's a challenge. But even bigger challenge than that is making sure that the resources for people to actually have a life in the community, that has become really a major challenge and has been part of what we've really been struggling with in developing the whole recovery approach to psychiatric challenges. And that is making sure that there are resources so that people can have lives that they want to live. And it turns out that when people were in a hospital, we forgot that the hospital actually provides not only psychiatric care, it provides, three meals, and it provides a cot, and it provides a roof, and it provides a social structure, and it provides social interactions. So that's the kind of thing that we've been learning, is that in order for people to have a place in the community, there actually has to be a place in the community. Like your question to me in the beginning about, where is this all heading, is really now about looking at community as a place that offers people the opportunity to thrive or not. And if we construct communities that don't offer people a chance to thrive, we're going to make their lives much harder the less opportunities there are for them to thrive. If we don't meet basic standards in terms of the kinds of resources that are available to people, both resources that are social resources, physical resources, material resources, if we don't have those kinds of things available to people and that they can use and that they have an opportunity to connect with, and that they feel free to use, that are culturally connected to them in a way that gives them a sense that they have meaning and purpose. If we don't do those things, then people are not going to be mentally healthy. But there are many ways that people become casualties of the circumstances, the context in which they live. And in a context that is vibrant, healthy, interactive, engaging, sharing, diverse, cooperative, you're going to have people who are going to do and feel better and have the capacity to be at their best. And if you have an environment that doesn't have those kinds of capacities, resources, approaches, you're going to have people who are really going to struggle and have a harder time than they would otherwise. And I think where we're moving to when we start thinking about populations is, how do we begin to construct together intentionally? This is not social engineering. I want to make a real big distinction here. This is not about somebody at the top saying how we're going to order our societies and how we're going to make sure that everybody fits into the right hole. More, this is about figuring out how all of us together are going to increase the opportunities and resources available to everybody, but with a particular eye on the folks who don't have those resources and options and opportunities available to them now. I think, in this idealized sense, what we want to really struggle for is create communities that are healthy by helping communities achieve the kind of social relations and the kind of structure of resources and opportunities that allow people to find a path towards flourishing.
Right. Absolutely. And so I like to think that, you know, that those who I consider my peers, which may not be everybody who works in mental health, that at least they're more sensitive to power dynamics than maybe would have been the case in one of the earlier eras that you talked about. That rather than, you know, going into places and telling them what it is that they ought to be doing, to invite them to, in effect, put us on notice about what it is that they really need, based on conditions as they understand them. I mean, is that your sense of it too?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely my sense of it. It's, you know, ultimately, you can't solve other people's problems for them without them. It just doesn't work. If we had a magic pill and people walked in and somebody could jam the pill in your mouth, whether you wanted it or not, and we were all, you know, better and fitter and smarter and, you know, all the things, then maybe my argument that you need to be engaged in this process wouldn't matter. But my suspicion is that if people feel like something is done to them rather than being a part of it, unless they've asked it to be done to them, they're going to reject it.
Right.
And they're not going to find it all that helpful. So the challenge of engaging people in finding the things that they can do, and by the way, I guess I should say, you know, that even if you could go in and just ask for help and have the help given to you, if you think that that is going to be sufficient for you to carry you through your life, all of us will quickly learn, I suspect, that doggone it, it takes a lot of effort,
yep,
by each of us individually to live our lives. And what we want to try to do is to make it possible for people to use their own capabilities and capacities to the maximum to allow them to push and be who they want to be to the degree that they would like to attain.
Right, absolutely. Now, you know, the evolution of language and paradigms is always fascinating to me. You know, there's even support for doing away with mental health in favor of health or wellness or flourishing or something similar. You know, just like we don't talk about mental hygiene anymore. So, I mean, do you have any opinion on that?
It's an interesting thing, and I think it's going to force us to to think a little bit harder about what we mean by what we are interested in talking about when we talk about mental health. Clearly, one of the lessons and messages of the last number of years has been that this idea that body and mind are not connected, that they are discontinuous things, is just very false. Our bodies and our minds are embedded in each other, and our brains are clearly part of our body. And so it's, when we talk about health, we are taking a position that suggests that we're thinking about the totality now more than we used to. Before, you know, health actually wouldn't carry the implication of what was happening on the quotes mental health side. It would be more about physical health and what happens to the body. But the body is the brain, and the brain is influencing the one of the main jobs of the brain is to influence what's going on in the body. I mean, so you're it's an impossible thing to actually make a disconnection. I used to give a talk in the early days of my involvement in trying to get this integration of in primary healthcare. I used to talk about the invention of the neck. That maybe it was time we started to notice that people actually had necks, and that when they walked into a psychiatric office, amazingly enough, their bodies were always attached. And whenever they went into a medical office, their heads were always attached. And unfortunately, our cleavage of the system into primary medical care and community mental health was sort of kind of the equivalent of the guillotine. in terms of making that stark separation that really doesn't exist. But the challenge is so if I say health is now whole body, whole person, we lose the notion about what mind is and begin to just think as though the brain is just another organ in the body that's like the heart or the lungs or whatever. And at some level, that's true. But what we have to remember is that the brain has a singular function as opposed to the heart. The heart exists to pump blood. The lungs exist to transfer oxygen into the blood. The brain, among some of the things it does at a kind of lower level, one of the chief things that it does is it produces mind. Mind is the thing in us that allows us to be both in the world and inside ourselves at the same time. But I ultimately think that when we talk about health, what we're going to end up talking about is this concept of personhood. And I think as soon as we do that, we'll be realizing that the core of being healthy is actually having a mind that is doing what it can to manage and navigate and create the world that we live in, each of us individually and each of us collectively.
Okay. And so my last question is, you know, one challenge in messaging across the health industry is going from buzzwords to people's lived experience. So getting back to this whole notion of communities, creating structures that allow for human flourishing. I mean, are there any promising models or success stories in this area that you're aware of that should be more widely known?
Now, that's a good question. The models that seem to work that I've seen are models that, or ways of thinking, models may be a little too structured a way to talk about this, ways of thinking that look for the capabilities and capacities of a person or an individual, you know, a person or a community, to look at what folks are capable of and what their capacities are, and then focus on trying to use those to the maximum extent possible, so that the way that we begin to think about how we grow our society to be more and more capable of producing people who flourish is that we constantly focus on what we need to do, each of us together and by ourselves, to maximize the things that are our capabilities and our capacities. There's a whole theory of community development, which sort of reflects this whole notion that we've evolved around recovery, which is the notion of community development I'm referring to is called asset-based community development. And what you do is you look in a community and you try to find the people and the resources that are functioning, that are flourishing, that have a talent or a skill or a capacity, and then you try to build on that talent, skill, or capacity and grow that. And as you do that, more resources, more capability seems to flow as people develop and create their opportunities. It's sometimes referred to as the health opportunity ladder. It's an asset that grows by using it. The health opportunity ladder is the idea that if you are healthy, you will take actions, be in the right place, or try to find the right place to be. You'll skate where the puck is going so that opportunity are more likely to come your way because you are in a position to take advantage of them and you're in a position to be where they need to be. And then the more opportunity you have, the healthier you become, or the healthier you are. And so it just kind of walks itself up. Healthy, more opportunity, more health. You have a full life across the life trajectory.
So this has felt like quite a brain dump. So I just learned about the health opportunity ladder. asset-based community development, some marvelous new buzzwords that we may have some fun unpacking in future conversations. I want to thank you so much for, you know, taking the time.
That was my pleasure.
Yeah, just to kind of join me in exploring some of these issues, because I think they're going to bear very much not only on the future of mental health, but, you know, the future of the Hogg Foundation as we try to figure out how we can plow our resources into mental health. And so I very much appreciate it.
I just appreciate this opportunity to talk about some of these ideas with you, and it was a lot of fun.
We hear a lot these days about population health and community health. They're similar sounding, but in fact have very distinct meanings. Here to clarify these important concepts and several others is Sheila Savannah of the Prevention Institute based in Oakland, California. The Institute uses a health equity lens in bringing cutting-edge research, practice, and analysis to public health and safety issues. Sheila, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for asking me.
So tell us about yourself and about the work that you do for the Prevention Institute.
Certainly. I'm one of the directors at Prevention Institute, where I lead our mental health work and also work on our health equity portfolio. I do a lot of our injury and trauma prevention work, including violence prevention. And in several places, that work intersects with our health system transformation. But it's all kind of built around the mental health and well-being work that we do. Prior to that, I spent 9 years working at the Houston Health Department. So I also bring to this work a background in looking at public health. And prior to that, I spent 20 years working in nonprofit, looking mostly at community organizing and coalition development, specifically around mental health and well-being for both children and families.
And so these days we hear a lot about population health and about community health. How do you define these terms, and how are they different?
Well, it's interesting because since I've worked so much in coalitions, the one thing I say is you always have to clarify how people are using these terms, because different sectors and groups use them differently and use them interchangeably. When I think about community health, I think about either geographically defining a community or using community to define a group of people that have some kind of connection and synergy, whether that's the recovery community or the military community or community based on interest. But also when you look at the term population, that tends to mean looking at the group of people that may be connected and may not be. And just depending on who's approaching it, I always delve deeper into that language with partners. Healthcare sometimes looks at population health as meaning those with a specific risk factor or with a diagnosis or those that are covered by a particular health care insurance program. And so just in the work we've done, we always ask people more deeply, what do you use to define community? And that's especially important when you're working with community residents and community-based organizations to really slow down and find out what are those definitions that are working for them.
I can see where, you know, people might often be talking about both at the same time, even if they might favor one term over the other, talking about population health and community health. Can you give an example of how they intersect?
Sure. So if I were talking about a particular neighborhood, I may be defining community as that particular geographic area. So I'd want to say, are we talking about a cluster of blocks or are we talking about a zip code? And really look at how we define community. And then as we look inside that community, we may want to together say, what population do we want to focus on? Are we talking about adolescents? Are we talking about students within a certain school feeder pattern? Are we talking about families that are impacted by the juvenile justice system? You know, what is the particular population in that community that we want to work with? And then the next layer may be even looking more deeply. Are we talking about a particular age group or students that have certain risk factors? So it's a layering, interchangeably using those terms, population and community, so that as you work with partners, as you work with others to really create solutions in communities, everybody has some agreement on what our end outcomes are focused on.
Speaking of language, we often use health equity around here. And, you know, most everybody acknowledges the existence of disparities, but can you give an example of a health equity issue that may not be so obvious to the layperson?
Sure. I usually, one of the examples that I think is particularly poignant is based on a study done in Chicago on residents of housing developments. And the study looked at the difference in life outcomes as well as life perspective of residents that faced the green space and the street versus residents that faced the parking lot, which pretty much had bars, security bars, but still bars that gave the sense of almost a prison. And just looking at the difference in their perspective on their life opportunities, that shows that environment really impacts how we experience, have emotional experiences, have health experiences. And so to me, that points to how just our environment can really shape what we think about health, how we think about our life opportunities, and how environment, especially the physical and built environment, really can lead to health disparities. Another example tied to that is if the green space close to you, whether that's a park, is just barren and really doesn't give opportunity for recreation or doesn't seem inviting, or if your pathway to that isn't walkable, then those things in your environment can lead to a disparity in your chronic well-being. So chronic diseases, when we really look at what are the factors that impact chronic illnesses, it's things like what's sold and how it's promoted that are around us. You know, what are the grocery store options? What are the eating food establishments? What's the food security like in that community? And then what access do we have to be active? And is it safe to get to the park? Is it safe to ride your bike? So when I think about health equity, I think about the decisions and the investments in communities that really lead to walkability, that lead to safety, that lead to good investments in having options in what to eat at an affordable cost, options in housing. I think similarly, transportation leads tremendously to disparities and health disparities. Are you able to get around? Or does the bus route have enough access to where you live? Or is it something where you have to walk a long way and spend several hours on public transportation to get to job opportunities or to get to educational opportunities? And so when we create these disparities in access to opportunities, we're also creating disparities in
right.
health. And I think people don't think about the connection between health equity and disparities, that we're almost producing the disparities when we don't address health equity.
Okay. And so thinking about health equity, and maybe this is me being naive, but I think the tide is starting to shift at least a little bit. And yet, it seems that at least in the world of philanthropy, that the focus is still on amelioration rather than prevention. And so I was wondering if there were any mature evidence-based approaches to prevention that you're willing to speak about, you know, particularly like, for example, violence prevention.
Sure. I think you raise the complexities of it, though. When we say evidence-based, in order to get to really understanding prevention, we need to change in many ways. We need to change our base of evidence. We need to be more open to look at contextual evidence, to look at a broader range of evidence. I think often the evidence base that we rely on is just a single focus of research where we're trying to isolate the complexities so that it's very pure research, and that tends to be our blue ribbon of standards. And community health and health equity, they're messy. They're complex. They're interwoven factors that need to be understood and taken into account. So I think we can better make traction in mental health philanthropy when we're willing to accept the fact that our evaluations, too, have to be complex. They have to be contextual. They have to be layered, just like life in communities are layered. And you asked about examples of mature prevention work. I think about the comprehensive planning that's gone into violence prevention in Minneapolis and several other cities that we work with through our Unity network. It starts with comprehensive planning. It starts with high level leadership across several agencies, meaning health, meaning justice, meaning law enforcement, education. The broader the number of sectors that come to the table and say, what is our comprehensive platform for reducing violence? That's the first step. One of the things that happened in Minneapolis is as they did that, they established a blueprint for how they wanted to reduce youth violence. And all of those sectors looked at how is it in their best interest and in their mandate to have a role in that. They looked at their discipline actions and how often their discipline actions were creating suspensions and expulsions that were resulting in a rising rate of youth violence. They started using more restorative justice practices in the school. Similarly, the juvenile justice system looked at what could they do to better make sure that young people completed probation, that they really addressed a comprehensive way for reentry when young people were arrested. How were they accepted back into the community and put on a pathway that allowed them to have better success and not fall back into the same patterns of crime and arrest? The nonprofits in the area looked at how are they investing in out-of-school time programming that was aligned with the greatest risk for youth violence. So that meant that the out-of-school time providers had to say, how do we expand our after-school and out-of-school time opportunities for older young people? For, you know, let's not cut off after-school time at the age of 12, but instead let's make sure that we have opportunities for activities for students that are 13, 14, 15, because that city saw that that's where their peak in violence was. One of the things that impressed me the most in Minneapolis is when you go there and you talk to different agencies or partners, they each feel like they have a role in this blueprint, in this success. And so by doing that, they distribute the responsibility, they distribute the success, and they've had tremendous results in terms of reduction of juvenile violence, increase in investment in juvenile jobs, increased success in school retainment. So I think those are the kinds of approaches that take time, but they also, more importantly, take a strong coordination. Also, that is a city where that comprehensive violence prevention plan has now moved beyond a single administration. So even as they've changed mayors, there's been a way for it to be embraced and built upon.
Okay. To follow up on what you said about contextual evidence. Research typically involves isolating a single variable as much as possible. But we do not live single variable lives. And so trying to come up with, forms of evidence that take that into account is both challenging but also crucial to what it is that we're trying to achieve, I would think.
Right. It is.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Sheila, we're so happy that you could take the time to talk to us. The intersection between public health and community health is something that I think that we're going to have quite a bit more to say about in the weeks to come. And so we're very happy that we could get some insight from you. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Sure. It was a pleasure talking with you.